This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Tech News Today for Monday, March 9th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by LegalZoom. It's National Start Your Business Month at LegalZoom and the best time to create the business you've always dreamed of. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they can connect you with an independent attorney. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TNT in the referral box to save even more. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 50-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. My name is Mike Elgin, and joining me as co-anchor is After Nine's content czar, Joe Panettiere. How you doing, Joe?
Doing great, Mike. How you been?
I've been great. I spent the last weekend right up till yesterday at Mobile World Congress and also in Barcelona, Spain, goofing around with my wife. And it was a lot of fun. The show was great. It was a really interesting show. And one of the most interesting things about it was the fact that there was a phantom presence, as there often is, of Apple at the show. Apple was everywhere. Nobody used the A word, really. But, I mean, every product that was coming out related to smartphones was in some way or another an attempt to respond to Apple in terms of price, design, features, the way people are using Apple devices with Apple Pay and all the rest. And so it was really, really something to see. And of course, Apple kind of ruined the whole event for almost everybody there by pre-announcing the event that happened today, the Apple Watch event, the Spring Forward event. Because that was sort of looming over the proceedings there. It was really kind of an interesting thing. Before we get into the big, big news today, though, I wondered if you had any thoughts about Mobile World Congress and some of the trends that that you witnessed with all the news coming out of the show.
Yeah, you know, I found Mobile World Congress interesting in that there was also a little bit of an enterprise presence there. Well, yes, it's mainly a consumer device show, but increasingly you do hear from consumer companies and or hybrid, what I would call B2B companies, making enterprise-related announcements. The prime example would be BlackBerry, you know, announcing not only new devices in the consumer space, but also announcing that more and more of their corporate services are moving out to the cloud. And I thought that was a great development. And I think it's great to see that this interjection of both the consumer side and the business side conversation happening in one place.
That is absolutely true. And the other thing is that all of the technologies around smartphones were very much in evidence. Virtual reality, biometrics, cars, connected cars, the Internet of Things, home automation, all of these areas of technology we don't often think of as smartphone technologies. But in fact, they very much are, especially the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is a result of much of the development that's going on with radios and batteries and Internet connectivity with small inexpensive devices. And it was everyone. Of course, the Internet of Things is going to be controllable by smartphones primarily. So that was a really interesting set of trends to see. It's a really exciting show. There's so much going on. And of course, it has to be said that one of the big trends there was the rise of Chinese brands, Xiaomi, Huawei, Lenovo, and so on. They were spending so much money on booth space and making so many deals. The Huawei booth itself was almost a show unto itself. They actually, there was so much traffic in and out of the Huawei booth that they had subway-like turnstiles just clocking people coming and going. And, you know, it was like a three-story tall booth with just mobbed with people, thousands of people inside the booth. It was really something to see. And, of course, you know, you go to a show like CES or any sort of U.S. show, you're not going to see a big presence by Huawei. So that was really interesting. The rise of, you know, ZTE, all these Chinese brands, they are coming on strong. They came on strong at Mobile World Congress. So that was really interesting to see.
Yeah, the other thing with the rise of these Chinese brands, Mike, is the fact that at around the same time, a few weeks ago, you got the Chinese government basically kicking U.S. companies off of their preferred product list, so to speak. So you've got the Chinese government saying we're no longer going to buy or certify these U.S. IT offerings into our market, but yet these Chinese brands are rising everywhere. So it's a very interesting balancing act going on in the market right now.
I think a lot of us know Huawei as a company that does, you know, consumer tech, but of course they are a big telecom company in China. They have, and that part of the company, probably the whole company, has close ties to the Chinese military, and that was one of the reasons they were suspected in a big congressional report a few years ago. China struck back and said, "Oh, you guys are spying on our stuff too." Turns out that was definitely true. The NSA was had infiltrated all kinds of brands, including Huawei, by the way. The NSA had code in there that was giving them the ability, theoretically, to spy on Chinese companies. And so, yeah, that was an interesting set of developments. And, of course, we learned much of this from the Snowden revelations. Well, Joe, it's a big, big day today in the world of technology, a huge day in Silicon Valley because, of course, Apple had a gigantic event, which everybody knew would be related to the Apple Watch. But there was other news as well that I thought was very, very interesting. And so we have three guests today that we're going to be talking with, starting with Philip Elmer DeWitt, who is an editor at – I'm getting your title wrong, Philip. Can you – what is your title now? I have independent technology columnist, but you write primarily for
– Fortune.com. I'm a senior editor at Fortune, and I can write about Apple for their website.
Wonderful. And we also are joined from the UK by Charles Arthur, who is with The Guardian. Welcome to you, Charles.
Hi there. I'm actually in Berlin at the moment, and I'm a freelance journalist, but apart from that.
Wonderful. Freelance journalist, and you're currently in Berlin. Thank you again for joining us. I know it's very late there, and I really do appreciate it. And we're also joined by Christina Farr, who is at KQED.org. And we've had you on the show before, but you've been at KQED for how long now, Christina?
About 2 weeks.
Wonderful. How's it going for you so far?
Yeah, it's great. It's a mix of radio and print. So I'm loving that.
It's great also because of KQED is a Bay Area organization and is very influential in the world of tech, much more so than a similar type of outfit that would be in another region. So that's a fantastic catch on their part as far as I'm concerned. And thank you so much for joining us. Now, we'll start with you, Philip. We all saw the event, a lot of products announced, a lot of non-surprises. Many of the rumors were true. We also had some details coming out that were not rumored, or at least the facts as revealed were not as rumored. What strikes you just looking at the 10,000-foot view from this announcement that surprised you the most? What did Apple announce that you thought, wow, I didn't see that one coming?
Well, you know, we all knew that there was going to be something about the watch because spring forward and daylight savings time and all that. Surprisingly, the biggest news and the news that affected the market the most was the new MacBook, really skinny, really light, hardly any ports, new kind of haptic feedback touchpad. And the market went wild. Apple stock price zoomed when they talked about the Mac. And they actually, I think, I didn't time it, but I think they spent more time talking about the Mac than they did about the watch. Now, because the watch was introduced in September in about 12 minutes, so we got a little taste of what the watch was going to do. We never got to actually use it. So the news on the watch was really, okay, what kind of apps do we have? And they did a pretty good demo, a day in the life of and showing all the different ways you can open your garage door and all that kind of stuff. And then they got to the meat of it, which was the pricing. And it was interesting that the rumors were pretty much right. They started $349. We knew that, and it's $50 more for the larger one. The gold one starts at $10,000. We didn't get the top price, what the gold is going to cost with the most expensive band, but $20,000 is possible. John Gruber, who put out a price list 2 days ago or 3 days ago, pretty much had it right, but he was wrong about what may be the most important, which is the steel one. He thought it was going to start at like $800, I think, and instead it starts at $549 for the smaller version and $600 for the larger. That is the one that I was thinking of buying. I think it was a lot of people who are considering buying a watch and are willing to put up some money to have one that's going to last for a while were thinking about this deal, and that's probably where they're going to make their biggest margin. What hasn't been answered, and we may not know for some years, is whether these things are upgradable, whether the Chinese billionaires who plop down $10,000 for the gold one are going to have to turn it in, you know, buy a new one in 2 years when Apple releases the new version. We don't know.
Phil, thank you for that. I want to jump over to Christina. I got a question for you. As we were warming up for the show, we were talking a little bit about the applications here and the software development kits. Christina, did anything here really catch you in terms of the apps they showed for the watch and or other software development kits they announced today?
Well, before they even started talking about the watch, they gave us a little bit of background on something they're calling Research Kit, which is a new platform for medical research. And I was really excited to see that because it really means that rather than focusing on well-being and overall health, that Apple is looking at tackling chronic disease. And they mentioned Parkinson's and asthma and a few others. So Apple's announced that they're partnering up with medical institutions like Stanford, and they've already been working behind the scenes on some apps that can track whether it's your heart rate, your movement, all kinds of things that would be relevant for someone who had a serious medical condition. So now we're seeing the iPhone become a medical diagnostic tool. So that's very interesting. And I would love to see kind of going forward how Apple conducts those relationships, what they're going to announce next, and how they deal with some of the privacy and regulatory aspects of this that might be a bit more tricky.
Christina, just to follow up on that, I thought it was kind of an interesting side note in terms of Apple's culture. Famously, Steve Jobs did not like to do what a lot of technology companies, deep pocket technology companies, like to do, which is, you know, donate a bundle of money. You know, Facebook, for example, Mark Zuckerberg is donating, you know, millions of dollars to schools and other causes. And Apple and Steve Jobs in particular always resisted that and said, you know, we make the world a better place by building products that are better. And it was that sort of line of thinking always kind of fell flat, especially as Apple grew in wealth and the amount of cash that they have on hand. And now we're into the Tim Cook, you know, years into the Tim Cook version of Apple. And here they are. They seem to have found a way to both honor the sort of attitude that Steve Jobs had about making the world better through products and also making the world better outside of the world of products through their products, if you know what I mean. So Research Kit is basically leveraging the user base of the iPhone and presumably Apple Watch world and adding to research with these, you know, we still don't know. One of the things we probably should talk about at some point is the quality of the sensor on the back that measures the biometrics. But here they are, they're contributing to science in some way. Do you think that this is something that they are going to be building as a business, that where they're going to make money, or is this a form of philanthropy for Apple? What is your feeling on that?
I definitely do not think that healthcare for Apple is a charitable endeavor. It's a massive multi-trillion-dollar market in the U.S., and Apple is not the only technology company right now that is thinking about making strides in health, particularly given kind of all of the buzz around mobile health. And for the very first time, people with an iPhone can actually contribute data to their doctors and say, you know, this is how I'm faring, this is how I'm eating, this is how many steps I'm walking every day. So I think Apple is really just jumping on a big trend. And, you know, perhaps it's going to lead to even more sales. And for Apple, it's, you know, the bottom line is usually how can we sell more devices, mainly iPhones. So they're building up these systems in healthcare that sort of lock in the electronic medical companies, the device companies, and the iPhone users. And it becomes, you know, a system that's really about the iPhone. It's an Apple ecosystem in healthcare. I also think that, you know, even before sort of Tim Cook really started to make moves in health and make announcements, Steve Jobs, towards the end of his life, became interested in health and had sort of long conversations with his doctor about why the industry was such a mess. So I think healthcare is personal. And at a certain point, you know, executives will find that they have an experience where they will see and notice kind of that there is a lot wrong with health. It's still very archaic in many ways. And I think, you know, Silicon Valley is starting to think, what can we do? How can we be involved to kind of fix this problem?
Yeah, Christina, great thought so far. And Mike, to continue along your thoughts in terms of the changing culture of Apple, I mean, one thing I noticed with this research kit was the fact that this is going to be an open source framework. This isn't some sort of closed environment. It'll be interesting just how open source is for Apple, but still the open source word was used. I want to throw it over to Charles now at this point. Charles, from your vantage point, as you were watching today's announcements, what did catch you the most? Was it the software development kits? Was it the actual Apple Watch and the positioning of it? Where did you really lean in to the conversation that Apple shared today?
Well, I thought that Research Kit actually was interesting because a lot of the – I was watching my Twitter feed as well, and a lot of analysts in there jumped in and said, wow, this is really interesting because other companies have been trying to get into this space, and they haven't been able to, and Apple seems to have done it straight away. Clearly, it's trying to do. It's not an altruistic endeavor. It's trying to make it so that iPhones and iPads and watches will be the first thing that researchers think about when they're trying to think of experiments and recruiting people for studies. So in that sense, they're just trying to embed the brand name. But it's definitely an interesting step forward. The MacBook, well, I thought that a lot of those details came out earlier this year. Mark Gurman, the 9to5 Mac, had a lot of details on this, including the fact that the USB-C. So it wasn't completely a surprise, but the actual the reality of it is it's a very small device. It's very light. The screen is fantastic. The keyboard feels nice as well. While the story, that's interesting to try to work out why people want to. They're trying to tell the story.
Okay, I'm sorry, Charles. We're having some problems with Skype. What we're going to do is we're going to Skype you back and get you back on the line. And while Jason is doing that, I wanted to throw it over you to Philip about Charles was talking about the new MacBook, which is 24% thinner than the MacBook Air. It weighs only 2 pounds. It's 13.1 millimeters thin, which is just microscopically thin. It had lots of different features, the USB-C connector. They even trotted out a list of eco benefits of how it's the world's most energy efficient laptop ever. But one of the things that I focused in on that I thought was kind of fascinating was the touchpad. The touchpad has Force Touch, which is a feature that they originally talked about for the Apple Watch, which means that it can detect how hard you're pressing it, and then that becomes a gesture. When you press it hard, that just pressing on something with a bit of force will cause an interface response depending on the context of what you're trying to do on screen. It also has this Taptics engine, which, again, we've only heard of in the context of the Apple Watch. So they built Apple Watch-like technologies, if you will, into this touchpad, and part of this seems to be trying to make it thinner, and part of it seems to be trying to revolutionize this interface, have something really unique to Apple devices. What did you think of the Philip? What did you think of the new MacBook in terms of its newsworthy? Yes, we've heard rumors from 9to5 Mac. Mark Gurman had a lot of these things, but Apple put a lot of these pieces together in a way that really explained what it is they're after. My own perspective was, again, as an Apple user, you can call me a fanboy if you want to, but my own perspective was that this was overall a very impressive device. What was your perspective?
Well, I really need to touch that touchpad to see how it feels. It's a new metaphor. We're used to buttons that actually move when you push them, that click. And this one is not going to move, maybe because there isn't room with it's such a thin device that there isn't room to have it actually toggle down. So instead of clicking when you push it, it is going to do a little buzz when you push it hard. And there's some advantages in that now it sort of is not binary. You can push and have, you can have things. They showed a demo where it speeded up a video depending on how hard you pushed it. We'll have to see. I wanted to talk a little bit about the health thing, if I could.
Sure.
I think there's a shift going on here. When they first introduced the watch, it was sort of the Tim Cook health nut approach to what this device would do for you. If you're the guy who goes to the gym at 4:30 every morning, you want to track how hard you run. And they did have they brought a model to the stage, Christy Turlington Burns, to run a marathon. But the thing is, most of us don't get up at 4:30 to run the track, and very few of us run marathons at Mount Kilimanjaro. So the shift was that it's now not so much health for you, the individual. It's health as a research device for the, you know, the research hospitals, and you know that's great, and my gut feeling is that there isn't that much, there isn't as much response to the watch as a health monitor as all this stuff, both the watch and the phone, is for the research community. One more thing that. Because I sat way in the back in the audience of this thing, the last row. I thought maybe someone would be smoking some dope. It'd be more fun. But what you see when
they were drinking Kool-Aid, not dope, not smoking dope.
What you see, well, speaking of Kool-Aid, what you see when you're in the back row is, you know how there's all these applause lines?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of applause in the middle of this thing? Well, all the applause is coming from the first three rows. Where the staff is, and nobody in the rest of the thing is applauding, and it's just something I always figured, but you see it so clearly when you're sitting in the back.
Yeah, you know, continuing on that app theme, Philip, what I noticed with these the health applications is this could turn into the world's biggest data application. All these iPhone users, iOS users sharing data could really be wild. But I wanted to pull Charles back into it. You know, Charles, from your vantage point, are there just enough apps yet? I mean, when we're so used now to app stores with millions of apps that keep us coming back to check out what's next. I wasn't exactly blown away by the sample apps today. I mean, I get it. There's going to be an airport app or a frequent flyer app, et cetera. But other than that garage door opening, nothing for me was an absolute wow factor. Was there a wow factor for you, and are there enough apps?
There are going to be plenty of apps. I mean, I've been trying out one called Departure Board, which is a UK one, which tells you what trains are departing from the nearest station. You know, trains are pretty big in the UK, and it's really great on a phone, and I think it'll be really good on a watch. Is you'll just sort of check it quickly and say, oh, okay, my train leaves in 10, 15 minutes or whatever. And it's that sort of little handoff from the phone to the watch, which I think is going to be really valuable. Those would be the sorts of apps which succeed. And it's really hard to demonstrate those in a presentation like this. It's really hard to show how it offloads the work from the phone onto the watch and how it just reduces the amount of time you have to spend pulling your phone out and going, okay, so where's my boarding pass? Well, here it is, I've got it. And all that sort of stuff. It's this, the smartphone has swallowed so many functions that we used to have individual things for. Now what it's doing is we're palming some of that work off and back onto other devices. In effect, we're sort of making the wrist a sort of a subspecies of the smartphone, but we're just handing time off so that we're not sort of troubling ourselves with the smartphone, because you know smartphones have got bigger apart from anything else. You know, you go back 7-8 years, they're all 3.5 inches on the diagonal. Now you've got them up to 5 inches, 6 inches. So taking your phone out of your pocket is a different proposition.
And Christina, you know, one of the things that I keep emphasizing whenever I write about or talk about the Apple Watch is the combination of user interface elements. For example, the haptics engine combined with the lights and sounds that appear on screen, the when you move the digital crown, how that you can feel the clicking of it, the communication by haptic touch, and so on. And this is not something you can demonstrate on stage, but I personally think that this could be the game changer for this device, simply because this is a form of communication not only between the watch and the user, but also between one user and another user, that involves, number one, an entirely different sense. Yes, we've had haptics engine before, but where it's been applied very intelligently, it has been central. If you think about Call of Duty on Xbox, for example, the Xbox controller is registering every hand grenade and every machine gun, and all, you know, and without the haptic feedback, it would be half the game. And I think that a lot of the interface innovation here is this Taptics engine. Do you think that this is going to be a factor, or will it be, as some have said, including Andy Anako when we did the live show on this event, who believes it's a bit of a parlor trick, that a bit of a gimmick that's not really going to make a difference? What is your view on this Taptics engine in particular and its combination with other user interface elements as a differentiator for Apple against other smartwatch brands?
I think it's definitely some advanced technology, but you have to think about who this watch is going to appeal to and who it will sell to. And I still think on the one hand, it's going to be, you know, those that really think about fashion and style and have never been able to wear a smartwatch before, because most of the sort of first generation are very clunky. And for those people, I don't particularly think it matters. It's the most important thing is things like the customizable bands. And the fact that you know, it is very personalized, and you can sort of be proud to wear it with a business suit, and you can wear it to the office. And then the other group that will sort of rush to the stores are those that are interested in their health and fitness. And we've talked a little bit about that. And the watch does already come with some very impressive apps for that. And one of the things you just showed on screen was the ability to kind of share heart rate between users. And I do kind of think that people will appreciate those touches that make you feel very connected to other watch users. And that's the kind of thing that's going to continue to boost sales of the watch. But we'll see. I mean, I still have my reservations on how well it's going to sell. But people always do, and then Apple proves them wrong.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Christina, that you bring up the sales question, because as we were warming up for the show, Philip was sharing some points there. And Philip, let's build on some of the points you shared before we went live here with the recording. And I guess my key question is this. When Apple came out with the phone originally, when iPhone first launched, there was this built-in audience because everyone knew a need for a cell phone. And by extension, there was at least a market there for Apple to tap. You know, with the watch, not everyone carries a watch or uses a watch anymore, or has a watch. And I'm wondering just what type of numbers you're thinking of in terms of what could be reasonable sales. I mean, Apple stock actually went down today at certain points during the watch presentation.
Yeah, my assumption is that everybody in the world above a certain age wants to carry a phone. And eventually they're going to be carrying a smartphone. It's a better buy. You have the internet in your pocket. Not everybody needs a watch that connects to their phone. It's a different value proposition. And in fact, the value proposition that they're selling today is, you know how what a pain it is to take your phone out of your pocket? Wouldn't it be great if you could look at your wrist instead? That's basically the story. And so what they're dealing with is a percentage of the market that already has a phone. It's an adjunct to the phone, a portal into the phone, if you would. And I did a survey of analysts in September, had them estimate how many watches they thought Apple was going to sell in the first year. And the average, I forget what the range was, but it came out to about 22 million. I did the survey again last week and got the same number, the same average. The range there was, I think, 8 million to 30 million in calendar 15. And I'm going to do it again, this week and see if it's changed. Basically, most of the estimates are based on what percentage of the installed base of phones they think are going to buy this. And we learned today that they've sold 700 million iPhones. If you figure probably 400 million of them are still in use, 10% of 400 million, which is what I've been hearing, gets you to 40 million iPhones. And that's actually above the high end of what the analysts are estimating, right at the high end. And I think Apple would be very happy to get that, especially if a lot of them are the steel one, which I think is where they're going to make their big money.
And Philip, I know you have a solid point about the utility of an Apple Watch. Nobody needs an Apple Watch. And I have a somewhat different perspective on that. My view is that nobody needs a smartphone either. We don't need good restaurants. We don't need entertaining movies. There are lots of things we don't need. which we spend a ton of money on. And I think that the reason that people get a high-end smartphone and the reason people might buy a high-end smartwatch is because it feels so damn good. Like, that's why the iPad sold. It was the user interface, the feeling of the physics of swiping around and zooming and pinching and all the rest. It feels good to use. And the question is feeling a little good using this personal device going to justify the price? I can't tell if this is a good price or a bad price. We're looking at ranging from $349 for the cheapest iWatch to $17,000 for the most expensive Apple Watch. Excuse me, I said iWatch, guy. We're still saying it. And the question is, you know, yes, people spend a fortune on watches, but if you buy a high-end regular watch, that watch will have probably even higher value in 30 years. An Apple Watch may have value as a kind of museum piece or some kind of curiosity, but it's not going to retain its value. It's going to be obsolete in 2 years, just like everything else Apple sells. So here we have this device that is really very expensive. The proposition that Apple is asking of its fanboy base is basically, we know you're spending X amount of dollars every year, and now we want you to spend a lot more every single year. And I can't tell if $349 is a low price or a high price, and I can't tell if $17,000 is a low price or a high price. Philip, what's your feeling on the pricing here?
Well, my assumption is that all the fast followers, Samsung and the rest, now that they see what the watch is, are going to build their knockoffs, and that if the Android iOS model is any guide, the cheaper ones are going to get 80% of the market, and Apple will take the 20% that is the most valuable, and that's how it'll shake out. Tim Cook keeps saying that his experience is that people really want the best if they can afford it, and that there's people in every part of the world who want the best, and he's happy to take the small percentage of the Indian subcontinent that can afford his products, and he'll take the fairly large percentage of the Chinese upper middle class that can afford this, and they will sell lots of these things is my best guess. But I don't think it's as big a market as the phone. I was talking to Horace Dedu before he went in. He thinks that the wearable market is actually bigger than the phone market, but he's talking about wearables in every, you know, wearables in your shoes, wearables on your belts, wearables in your clothes. He doesn't know when it's going to happen, but he sees computers and software invading every corner of our lives, and that this is basically day one. Google failed with its Google Glasses. I suspect Apple's got a hit on its hand with the watch, despite Wall Street's reaction today when they heard the pricing.
I think there's no question that the wearables market is going to be huge and pervasive, and it's going to involve clothing and all the rest. For now, it's very clear that it's going to be the smartwatch. Even if somebody comes out with a more compelling version of Google Glass or something, it's never going to, or at least for the foreseeable future, it's not going to match the wristwatch. A wrist is a fantastic place for a universal controller, for your TV, for you open your, you know, unlock your car, all the rest, to get notifications, to communicate, to talk on the phone, as they demonstrated today at the event. And so, yeah, I think that Apple has once again positioned itself in the sweet spot of the market. They will not. There's no way they're going to be able to own the market for 2 years like they did with the iPad. Those days are gone. I agree with you. Samsung and everybody else is going to be right on their heels with a lot of these similar functionality that Apple has come out with. Now, Charles, I want to just quickly end with you. Now, of course, they announced lots and lots of things, as they tend to do. The new MacBook. They also mentioned the upgraded MacBook Air. Everything's faster. Everything's getting better incrementally. They announced the Apple Watch, ranging from $349 to $17,000. Lots of details there. They showed some user interfaces that we hadn't seen previously, and they trotted out some of the information that they had talked about previously. But some of the things we haven't talked about yet is the Apple TV. They're adding content providers. They got a big, big splash. In fact, they opened the event with a HBO Now conversation with their exclusive partner. They're going to have the Game of Thrones. They played a really long game and very violent Game of Thrones trailer, which was kind of an interesting way to open an Apple event. They talked about a reduction in price for the Apple TV down to $69, which always indicates that they are feeling the pressure from others. They also talked about some numbers that were, you know, the sort of usual bragging that they do. 700 million iPhones sold. They are the number one phone in the fourth quarter. I assume he's talking about the fourth quarter. And they have a 99% satisfaction rating. I doubt that's across the board for all satisfaction ratings, but the one they wanted to focus on gave them a 99% satisfaction rating. And they talked about the success of Apple Pay. So, Charles, if we can just ask you to sort of summarize what you thought was the biggest news out of this event overall, what struck you as both the most interesting new information and also the most important information about what they announced and where Apple is going as a company.
Okay, so one little tidbit. The thing where he said 700 million phones, if you do the math, say it sold 660 million by the end of 2014. So it means that in as of this year, they sold 35 million. So they're on track of probably about 50 million by the end of this quarter, which would be substantially up from last year. So you can see the iPhone is still roaring here. Other thing I would say about as a company, the Apple Watch is a watch in as much as iPhone, the first iPhone was a phone. You know, it sort of is, but really it isn't. And you know, to think of it as a watch is just not the way to do it. The first iPhone didn't have 3G, it couldn't do multimedia messaging services, video, it was very limited. I think that the first Apple Watch is pretty good. It'll get a lot better as they go forward, and I think that it will have a transformative effect on how people think about the wearables markets overall. They probably will look back in 5 or 10 years and say, oh, okay, that was the thing that we indicated on. So I think that's actually the most important thing about today is that you finally have a wearable device that people really think, oh, okay, I sort of see how that works. And I think it'll kickstart, rather like the iPhone, it'll kickstart a much broader move towards this category for everyone.
And Philip Elmer DeWitt, can you give us your final thoughts briefly about this event and what you think the big impact is going to be from what they announced today?
I do think it's about the watch. Apple has, you know, maybe the thing to say is that all the doubts that we had about the company after Steve Jobs died, could they still deliver? Could they still innovate? Were there any new products? I think that got answered, probably got answered last fall when they showed the watch for the first time. It got reinforced today. And one of the things that Tim Cook kept saying as he closed was that this is just the beginning and we're focused on doing more of this kind of stuff. And with the rumors about, you know, hiring the car guys and so forth, you can see that Apple is looking ahead. What long term, what products can we make where we can add some value and make people's lives better and all that kind of stuff and make a lot of money? And I think they put down the gauntlet and they showed that they can do it. And I think there's going to be more credibility coming up in the future about what other products they might have cooking.
And Christina Farr, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I'm just kind of excited still by this research kit announcement and see where they can go. And the way that Jeff Williams kind of first made the announcement, he said, you know, we had a lot of conversations with folks in the medical world and we saw what we could make a difference. So I don't know necessarily whether this was something that they had intended to do even a year ago, but it's clear that they are also just looking for new and innovative ways that they can add value. And they're prepared to experiment, and this could be a total failure. Who knows? But I'm glad to see kind of Apple still treading new ground.
Wonderful. You can catch up with Philip Elmer DeWitt at fortune.com and also on Twitter at Philip ED. That's Philip with one L. Thank you for joining us today, Philip. All right. And Christina Farr is at kqed.org, and you can follow her on Twitter at Chrissy Farr. Thank you for joining us today, Christina Farr.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, from Berlin, where it's very late and very distant, if you're going to gauge that on Skype connections, is Charles Arthur, who's an independent journalist who often writes for The Guardian. And you can follow him on Twitter at Charles Arthur. Thank you so much for joining us and hanging in there through that Skype connection. Again, thank you, Charles. Well, we've got some more news for you coming up. But first, let's talk about LegalZoom. You know what this month is? It's March. It's National Start Your Business Month at LegalZoom.com. And if you've always wanted to start a business, you know, go to LegalZoom.com right now and check out how easy it is. People are often intimidated by the idea of starting a business because they're not really sure how to set up the corporation, what kind of corporation to set up, how to get all the documents filed, how to do all the things that you have to do to be a business. LegalZoom.com is the place to get all that stuff. And you can just browse. It's like shopping for all the options for your small business. It's absolutely the way to go. And they've helped 1 million business owners, just like you could be if you want to start your own business. Go to LegalZoom.com today and find out more. If you need an attorney, they can give you attorney consultations. They're provided by an independent attorneys, and they'll give these consultations to you in most states. Get the legal help you need for your business at LegalZoom.com. Make sure you enter the offer code TNT in the referral box to save even more. That's LegalZoom.com and use the promo code TNT. Legal help is here. The Wall Street Journal reported Friday that Google is working on a virtual reality version of its Android operating system. The company has tens of engineers working on the project. If the company follows through on its plans, the company would have 5 versions of Android, including 1 for phones and tablets, another for wearable devices, another for TV sets, and yet another for cars. Google is also a major investor in the virtual and augmented reality company Magic Leap. Joe Panettiere, I hadn't really thought of them creating a virtual reality version of Android, but it makes it total sense. And of course they're going to do this. Of course they're going to work on it. They have to have it ready because when the virtual reality, augmented reality universe explodes, they can't start at that point because they'll completely miss the boat. They have to be working on it now. I think this is really cool because if it's Android, that means it could very well have an open source version. It very well could be widely distributed. It could very well work perfectly on smartphones like the, you know, the Google Cardboard edition. Are you surprised by this at all? And what are your thoughts on Google Android for virtual reality?
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm surprised at all. You think of Google, you think about how much software and how many cloud services they always announce as quote-unquote beta and keep them out there for years and years before they even go mainstream. So this doesn't surprise me. What I would watch here, Mike, is the fact that Google has to make sure that they don't, in fact, fork Android. And what I mean by that is they've got so many versions running at this point and so many that may or may not be coming in the pipeline that you want to make sure that there's still that common code base so that app developers don't have to do major, major overhauls as they move from one hardware platform to the next trying to write for Android. So I'll be curious to watch that. And you know, it's funny. It almost reminds me of Microsoft in the 1990s when they had a version of Windows for the car and they had consumer edition of Windows and then Windows NT and Windows 95. And on the one hand, it was all branded as Windows. On the other hand, there were a lot of different code bases and Microsoft ran into problems and ultimately tried to get it down to one code base, especially now with Windows 10, if you fast forward to the present. So I'm curious to see how Google makes sure that Android itself doesn't fork underneath Google's own umbrella.
It also has to be said that I think that we always talk about virtual reality, and I think virtual reality will actually be pretty rare. I think most of the things that we think of in terms of virtual reality applications, games and you know simulations and all the rest, will mostly be augmented reality, similar to Microsoft Halo. Right. And the reason for that is in order for you to have virtual reality, in order for reality to be completely replaced visually, you need a padded room or some kind of cabling or something. You really don't want people tripping over tables and so on. You have to integrate reality.
You need a Star Trek holodeck, basically, to get it right. So you're exactly right, Mike. And I think with virtual reality or augmented reality, you're right. I think it'll be the game generation that gets it going. And, you know, I hate to go down this road, but you never know if the adult entertainment scene is also a big driver here. You know, anytime there's a new platform, whether it was VCRs or gaming or the internet, It was always about entertainment and or adult stuff going on.
Jason is telling me that they already have an adult themed virtual reality thing. We won't ask him how he knows that.
Right.
We'll just keep the show moving, you know, and we'll pause it.
Is that a recurring expense or just a one-time expense, Jason?
Okay. Well, yeah, it is really exciting. And of course, if you've got any thoughts about virtual reality on phones of the Android version or whatever, just send email to tnt@twit.tv. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the coming world of virtual reality, including the Android version. Well, the San Francisco-based mobile payments company Square today will unveil two new services, according to an exclusive in the New York Times. The first is instant deposits, and the second is new protection for purchases that are disputed. The features are clearly aimed at attracting more small businesses. This is great news, Joe. Basically, what they've done is they came out with their, you know, we've all seen the Square things. You plug it into an iPad or something, you swipe your credit card, and a payment is processed. Cash register replaced. And now, you know, now we're looking at a scenario for this company for them to legitimize themselves. They have to go through each of the pain points that small businesses are having with their device and solving them.
Yeah, not only the features you recommended, Mike, but you know there was something else. If you go back to their user interface there on their website, there's a tab there that talks about the analytics power here, and that's a really important point. So if I'm a small business, Mike, using their software, their cloud services, I can figure out who are my most profitable customers, who really drives my profits, you know, who's in my store most frequently or buying from me most frequently. And the analytics here really, really continue that approach that small businesses are growing up and are going to be able to compete with the big retailers out there.
For example, if you're looking at the video version of the show, you can see that alcohol is twice as profitable as burritos.
There you go.
I don't know what business this is. But, I mean, I guess we could have predicted that. In security news, GigaOm reports that the largest email providers in Germany will soon enable and encourage their customers to use strong end-to-end email encryption. The providers are Deutsche Telekom and United Internet. Next month, they plan to unveil a browser plugin that makes PGP easier to use. But here's the really interesting part and the part of the news that lets you know that this is not the United States or the UK. According to the report, the encryption program appears to have the full support of the German government. Wouldn't that be nice if we had a government who was like, yes, we want to have strong encryption
now,
on everybody's
Mike.
Email.
Yeah, let's not go too far and actually secure things around here, Mike. You'd never want to do that. It'll be interesting to see the U.S. government's reaction to this. You know, especially the other thing I noticed on the wires today, Mike, is that the FCC is encrypting their website as well. So now you're starting to see U.S. government agencies, in addition to these application providers abroad, starting to use encryption everywhere. And yet the U.S. government has been so vocal and concerned about Android getting encrypted and iOS getting encrypted. And yet it is a best practice and it's going to become universal.
Encryption itself, it sounds like that would be the hard part. But it turns out that the hardest part of encrypted email is making it easy enough to where everybody just uses it. Right now, it's too hard to use. It's gotten way easier than it used to. I mean, years ago, it was very difficult. In fact, the Snowden revelations themselves were delayed by 5-6 months because the main journalist who was being leaked to, or you know, that Snowden wanted to leak to, just couldn't get his head around setting up PGP for his email. So he just kind of blew him off and put it off. And it wasn't until later that Laura Poitras, I think her name is, the filmmaker who was part of the being leaked to, convinced Greenwald to use PGP. And then once he did, he got the emails from Snowden, and it was the Snowden revelations, the thing that made Greenwald's career. So, you know, this is the problem, making it easy. And supposedly, and of course, we haven't had a chance to look at this or test it, but supposedly that's the secret sauce here that they're doing in Germany. It's a browser plugin that makes it easy. And that's really the challenge here. Microsoft is suing Kyocera over patent infringements. These patent infringement lawsuits never end because, of course, every smartphone has a million patented bits of information, of, you know, technology in it. The patents in this case are related to power management, contextual awareness, text messaging, and multitasking used in Kyocera's Android phones. Microsoft is seeking damages and an injunction on the sale in the U.S., of Kyocera phones. And Joe Panettiere, my prediction is that they'll win something in this lawsuit. They may not get everything they want. They probably won't get the injunction. Judges are very reticent to do that sort of thing, and I think they should be. It really shouldn't be possible for a company to preemptively block a company's products simply on the claim before it's proved in court that something is infringing patents. But still, these are the very same patents that other companies are paying Microsoft royalties for, and therefore my guess is the courts will uphold Microsoft's view on this.
Yeah, you know, and it's also scary times because you think about whether it's Android on the front end or cloud platforms like WordPress on the back end. All these platforms now are using so much open source code and shared code that gets plugged in all over the place. And you wonder if and when there's a trickle down effect where Microsoft isn't just going after one company, they start going after a string of companies because you didn't even know you're using a particular code that may or not infringe on a patent. You just happen to pick it up and plug it into your solution. So I think it's scary times out there for anyone who's piecing together either, you know, the mobile solution or the back-end cloud solution.
It really is. And people, you know, who use smartphones, which is absolutely every single one of us, needs to know where the money is in smartphone technology. There are certain companies that have lots of patents and technology, and sometimes these are surprising companies like Microsoft, for example, which I've heard makes more money on Android than they do on their own phone platform. and companies like, you know, Ericsson, you know, of all companies. And so, you know, not very many companies are actually making money, profits, on selling smartphones. Apple's getting 93%, Samsung's getting the rest pretty much, and almost all the rest of the money is made through the technology that was developed years ago for things like radios and wireless technologies and user interface things and all these little bits and pieces that make up a modern smartphone, and that's where they're making money. So it's really, you know, from a business perspective, there's probably, you know, it's probably a better business to be in the patent lawsuit business, if you will, or licensing, than it is to actually sell phones.
Yep, and hence all the patent trolls.
Exactly. Well, we've got a big number for you today, 600. That's how many employees Tesla may be laying off in China after reporting weak sales there. Estimates in the local press range from between 180 and 600 employees who could be let go. The company has reportedly sold only 2,500 cars in China since sales began in April of last year. You know, the big thing is you think, wow, you know, the status conscious China, you think they'd be gobbling up these Tesla cars. Fact is, it's hard to find a place to charge them. Lots of people live in apartments. So where do you put the charger? You know, if you have a single family home with a garage and all the rest, that makes a lot of sense to have a Tesla in that garage. But if you don't have a garage, you know, it's an entirely different problem. Do you think that they'll eventually be able to turn this around somehow, Joe? Do you see any light at the end of the Chinese tunnel for Tesla?
You know, I don't. You know, I'm not quite sure how they fix this. But on the other hand, I think the company that's really watching this closely is probably Apple. And you think about the war room Apple must have right now in terms of watching every Tesla move. And think about the Tesla brand. It's an incredibly well-known, strong brand, particularly here in the U.S. And if Tesla's having challenges, what does it mean for the rest of the industry overall as we all move to, you know, greener types of cars? And what does it really mean for Apple's ambitions here? So I think the company to watch in terms of pivoting off this is potentially Apple.
I think you're probably right about that. And of course, as soon as it becomes feasible for large numbers of highly profitable electric sports cars to be sold in China, I'm sure there will be several Chinese companies who will be happy to compete with Tesla, with possibly Apple, and sell cars at half the price. So that would be an interesting market there. And I think we're really heading into a world in probably 5-10 years where electric cars will be the norm and gas-powered cars will be rare. And I think China needs that really badly. So does India. So does the United States, for that matter. We need to get moved to cleaner sources of car energy. Well, in news you can lose, you're not going to believe this one, folks. U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, who's a member of the Senate Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law, admitted on TV over the weekend that he has never, ever sent a single email in his entire life. Let's watch this video.
I have confidence that Trey Gowdy will get to the bottom of this. And at the end of the day, what I want was any other cabinet member during the time that she served, did they have a private email account?
Do you have a private email address?
For me to know all.
Do you have a private email address?
I don't email you. No, you can have every email I've ever sent. I've never sent one. So I don't know what that makes me, but it may. but really, this is big in this regard. Did she communicate on behalf of the Clinton Foundation as Secretary of State?
Right.
Did she call the terrorist attack in Benghazi?
All right, well, he's going to drone on and do his political positioning there. This admission took place during a conversation about the Hillary-Clinton email scandal on the show Meet the Press. Senator Graham said, quote, "I don't know what that makes me," unquote. So I will tell him, "Senator, here's what it makes you. It makes you unqualified to sit on the Senate Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law." Isn't this incredible, Joe Panettiere, that a congressperson is so out of touch with reality that he's never sent an email? It's incomprehensible.
It's incomprehensible, but I will connect the dots to my own situation. Last week, I was trying to follow up on a report that the state of California is going to hire a chief data officer, and a certain senator is leading the campaign for this. So I emailed that senator. Then I emailed that senator again. Then I emailed that senator again, Mike. I've yet to hear back. So maybe this explains the silence.
It reminds me of the UN. Like, a lot of the committees at the United Nations are headed up by countries that really shouldn't be involved. For example, I know that for years, the head of the Committee on Sustainable Economic Development was headed by North Korea. And years ago, I recall that a committee on something about freedom, or I don't remember what it was, but essentially it was a committee that went after, it was anti-torture and so on. It was headed by Libya. And so, you know, this is just crazy that somebody like this would be on a committee. You know, he's obviously a very successful senator. He's one of the leading senators in government. But I just can't imagine where he lives, what sort of reality he lives in, that he's never sent an email. Well, we've got a wrap-up coming up in just a second. But first, let me tell you about ZipRecruiter. We're talking about small business today. I know we have thousands and thousands of small business owners who watch this show and listen to this show. And of course, you know, as a small business owner, that the way to succeed is to hire the right people. If you hire the wrong people, that could be the end of your small business. And if you hire the right people, that could be the beginning of you growing it into a large business. And the way to do that, of course, is ZipRecruiter. That is the way, because you can send out your job to 50 plus job sites with a single click, including social networks like Facebook and Twitter and Google Plus, all again with a single click. You can find candidates in any industry nationwide. Post, watch those qualified candidates roll in into their easy to use interface. And one of the problems, of course, with hiring, if you've ever done it, I've done a lot of hiring myself, is you get so many unqualified candidates that really, I mean, it sounds callous, but you know, it wastes your time for somebody who they know they're not qualified. They're not qualified on paper. They're not qualified off paper. And yet you have to spend the time to go through and determine that on your own. Well, ZipRecruiter can help you with that by separating the most qualified candidates from the least qualified, so that you can spend your precious time on the people who are genuinely qualified. It's really a really great system. And that's why ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 200,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners and viewers can try ZipRecruiter for free, plus get 30% off the first traffic boost by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Our TNT fan of the day is Keith Townsend, who posted this picture on Twitter and says he listens during his 60-mile daily commute. 60 miles, Joe. This sounds like he lives in Long Island and works in Manhattan.
It sounds like we need to extend the length of the show for him.
Exactly. Right. Or, you know, just he can listen to it twice. We'd be happy about that. Yeah, it's a great I personally listen to a lot of Twit shows when I'm driving around, when I'm doing stuff around the house. I'll watch them if I can. And if I can't watch them because I got, you know, 2 and 10 on the wheel there, I listen. And it's just a great thing. And we're glad to be part of his horrific commute. I hope we make it a little bit less so. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT and we will find it. Joe Panettiere, what in the heck is going on at After9s.com?
Well, thank you for asking. I'll give some more information tomorrow on Tuesday, but here's a teaser for you. Tuesday night at 9:01 p.m. Eastern, we've got a podcast with a tech entrepreneur, who has raised money for multiple startups over the last 20 years. And he has seen a major pivot point in terms of how exactly to raise money from VCs and angels and what it all means to you. So that is podcast episode 25 on our website on Tuesday night at 9:01 p.m. Eastern.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for co-anchoring today. Great stuff as always. And again, Joe, thank you. And we'll see you again tomorrow.
Absolutely, Mike. Thanks.
All right. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on iTunes, and please leave a review and let us know how you like the show. Choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT, and you can watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv or on the app or browser plugin of your choice. If you're ever near Petaluma, California, the tech broadcasting capital of the universe, come on in and watch us live. We love to have a live audience. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me personally on Twitter at twitter.com/Mike Elgin. Let us know what you think. Send an email to tnt@twit.tv or call us at 260-TNT-SHOW and leave a message. Also, don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.